Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today's guest, Dr. Willie Parker, performs abortions in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. But he wasn't always pro-choice. As an OBGYN, he felt abortion was morally wrong. And then he read a sermon by Martin Luther King Jr. In a New York Times op-ed, he writes, quote, "My concern about women who lacked access to abortion became more important to me than worrying about what might happen to me for providing the services," end quote. Today, Dr. Willie Parker is on the front lines of the battle over a woman's right to access abortion and make her own decisions. While women across the country are losing access, the South is the most restrictive. These restrictions are hurting poor women and women of color the most. A Harvard-educated OBGYN from Alabama, Dr. Willie Parker has been providing abortions full-time since 2009. He has sued the state of Mississippi to keep the only clinic that provides abortions open. He prevailed twice, but the fight continues. Dr. Parker is board chair for Physicians for Reproductive Health and author of the forthcoming book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. And Dr. Parker is in town to receive an award from Planned Parenthood, and he joins me here in studio. Hi, Dr. Parker. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, my pleasure.
I want to ask you first about the way that this issue is framed in the media. We hear, for as long as I can remember, and probably 2 weeks ago when Donald Trump signed the global gag rule, that abortion is the most divisive issue in the country, and it divides us. But according to a recent Pew poll, 69% of Americans support Roe. The Wall Street Journal came out with a poll about 4 years ago that found 70% support Roe, the highest numbers we've seen, 84% Democrats, Republicans just over half. Can you talk a little bit about this and why you think abortion is always framed as sort of a divide, such a divisive issue?
Well, I think it's related to what I call a false equivalency. The pro-choice, pro-life narrative lends itself very well to spirited debate, and that makes for good drama and good theater. But I think it's a false equivalency because the narrative that we call pro-life, pro-choice is really pro-abortion, anti-abortion. And when you say pro-abortion, nobody's really for abortion. And I don't back away from it in terms of framing abortion as a tragic narrative or a tragic choice. But what people are for is the health and well-being of women. And abortion is just one of several reproductive outcomes on a continuum. So the rhetoric around pro-life and pro-choice really is a framing of the reproductive decision-making of women about whether or not to continue a pregnancy. And when you talk about abortion as one of several reproductive health outcomes, and one of which a woman should be empowered to choose to the benefit of her health and her well-being, then it's not as dramatic a decision. And then the numbers that you cited make sense. Hmm. Most people understand that there are situations where pregnancies are desired and yet lethally flawed or a threat to the health of the woman. And many people understand that despite the best effort of people to prevent pregnancy, sometimes they happen.
Right.
So a pro-life, pro-choice narrative is a false dichotomy of reproductive decision-making.
The other thing that gets me is we are seeing extreme anti-choice laws pass across the country. But when those laws are taken directly to voters, even in places like South Dakota, they almost always are defeated. Even the most conservative voters defeat these propositions. What are your thoughts about that? We don't hear that very often in the media.
Well, what that represents is that people are reasonable. And people can handle the truth, and they can handle complexity. And when issues are really framed in their in the context of what's really at stake, people act in their own interest, and they common sense prevails. So when you get away from cliches and rhetoric that circumvent critical thinking, when you frame the fact that 88% of abortions happen in the first 12 weeks before there's any point of viability. And when you frame the fact that there's no question that there are women for whom abortion is a life-saving measure, what you get is that the numbers that you talked about earlier, where people realize that nobody's real. There are people who may not sign off on every situation and approve of abortion, but they certainly recognize that when it is necessary, they make room for people to make their own decisions around it.
I was struck by an article recently, actually it was in December, about Planned Parenthood convening six small focus groups in swing states, and they asked voters who cast ballots for Donald Trump what they thought about abortion rights. I'm reading this story from the Washington Post. The first half of conversations found that these voters reluctantly voted for Trump. Some had a lot of worries. They said that they want him to oppose any attack on Planned Parenthood's federal funding. And when they learned about how extreme Mike Pence is on issues like abortion and LGBT issues, they were shocked. Mm-hmm. Because remember during the vice presidential debate, the moderator failed to ask about social issues, and the Clinton team really didn't talk about that. So a lot of people just didn't know about Mike Pence's extreme anti-choice record. And according to these gatherings, these Trump voters do not want them to take such extreme action. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, my thoughts are that it's like the line from the movie A Few Good Men, where Jack Nicholson and Tom Cruise, and he said, "The truth, you want the truth, you can't handle the truth." And what I mean by that is that people who are very paternalistic and who've become clear about what formula motivates people to act against their own best interests, framing issues in oversimplified terms and framing them as values issues, when what your real agenda is fiscal conservatism, you show people, you talk about jobs and tough on crime and on protecting the borders, but at the end of the day, you use the issues to mobilize people around saying we have a culture of life. And that oversimplified notion of reproductive decision making has left people with buyer's remorse. Hmm. You know, you can show all the bells and whistles on the car, but if the carburetor's shot, you know, once you sign the contract and you drive the car off the lot, you realize that you got dealt a lemon. And I think, unfortunately, the harsh reality is that a lot of Trump voters, whether you're talking about the implications of reversing the Affordable Care Act and a lot of other things that people thought, well, maybe abortion doesn't really affect me as a man, but, you know, if he also is going to roll back the Affordable Care Act, that means that I can't get my medicines as a coal miner in West Virginia.
Right.
So people have buyer's remorse. Mm. And it's just, you know, it's the epitome of cynical manipulation of political power.
And yet here we are in 2017 where politicians proudly embrace a policy to oppose abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. We did not hear this kind of rhetoric in the 2004-2008 elections.
Yeah, you know, I think the mortgaging of their integrity by the religious right, and the amplification of a monotone narrative that frames every issue in the context of abortion or other values issues allow the religious right to make the conscious decision to support Donald Trump, despite everything about his business practices and his personal life and his both his fiscal and his social values being antithetical to everything they stand for. They made the conscious decision to push him forward, and that was much to the abandonment of their responsibility to helping their followers to act in a conscientious way politically.
You perform abortions in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. Do you interact much with people who voted for Trump?
I'm sure there are people who are on the abortion table who voted for Trump.
I mean, do you have conversations with people about the decision, why they did it, and what they think about where we are today?
Well, it's still too new, and to be honest with you, I kind of let people drive the conversation. I think it would for me to indulge myself to steer people towards political conversations at that moment.
I didn't mean at that moment, but more in social settings, out at restaurants, just in your everyday life. In Birmingham, for example, do you have colleagues or friends or just people you know who voted for Trump? Do you have conversations?
Well, not many conversations with people who voted for Trump. Okay. I don't travel in those circles.
All right. Well, let's talk about your personal story, because before you started providing abortions, you spent 12 years as an OBGYN, and at that time you felt abortions were morally wrong, and you wrote about this in a New York Times op-ed, and you wrote that you grew increasingly uncomfortable turning away women who needed help. And this is because you read a sermon by Martin Luther King Jr. Can you tell us about that?
Yeah, well, I think it's been often reported that the narrative appears to be more dramatic than it is. I was never opposed to abortion. I was always supportive of a woman making her decision. I felt morally conflicted about what it would mean to me as a Christian providing abortions when I hadn't explored more deeply what the teachings or what the possibilities for understanding abortion as compassionate action, how that stacked up with traditional thoughts about what Christianity constituted. So I never blocked a woman. Whenever I had a patient who had an unplanned or unwanted pregnancy or wanted, belieffully flawed one, I always referred them on. But increasingly, I felt uncomfortable not examining more critically what my reservations were with regard to what it meant to me personally to provide them. And so when I realized that on a regular basis I was seeing women who needed abortion or seeking abortion care, and that it's something that one in three women by the time of age 45 in this country need, I had to figure out what it meant to me. Why was I becoming uncomfortable not doing this? And the last speech by Dr. King, I call it a sermon, was his mountaintop sermon, where most people remember the day before he was killed, he talked about having been to the mountaintop. But in that same sermon, he tried to articulate the lost value of other concern about people. And when he talked about what made the Good Samaritan good, he describes the person who stopped to help someone that no one else was willing to help. And he said that what made that person good was, whereas everyone else asked, what will happen to me if I stop to help? This person asked, what will happen to this person if I don't stop to help? And that just hit me in the gut as someone seeing women who needed my help. And I just found it increasingly more difficult to self-describe as a woman's help provider and yet failing to provide the one service that many, many women will come to need in their lives. And so it was transformative for me. And that notion of being concerned about others, for me, I became empowered to, and that it was appropriate for me to think about what's in the best interest of my patients. And I became less concerned about what might happen to me for doing that.
That was back in 2009 when you started providing abortions. And
that was actually back in 2004 when I was in the University of Hawaii. When I left Hawaii to go and get additional training in abortion care, I didn't get any formal training during my residency, and so I decided that if I was going to do this, that I want to have a definitive knowledge and skill. So I left my practice in at the University of Hawaii and went to the University of Michigan to do a fellowship in family planning, and that was back. That was in I left in 2006.
What is being taught in medical schools today? There's a group called Medical Students for Choice. We've done shows about this, and we'll talk later about the violence that doctors and clinic workers have to face and the intimidation every day. But can you tell us what's happening in medical schools today?
So Medical Students for Choice is, I say it's the consumer demand in medical education for the content that would allow them to provide women with comprehensive health services. A doctor here in the Bay Area, Dr. Jody Steinhauer, who was on faculty at UCSF, as a medical student, made the decision to start an organization where students, medical students, could lobby and request access to the abortion education and in abortion care, so that they can, for people who chose to go into medicine to be women's health providers in the first place, that they would have that content made available to them. So they've become a very important group from the consumer demand side, driving medical education towards providing that content for them. And so in that same regard, there's an organization called the Family Planning Fellowship that's also administered out of UCSF that administers funds provided by a very large anonymous donor to support resident education in abortion care. It's called the Kenneth J. Ryan Residency Training Program. And so OBGYN residencies around the country can seek funding to support the creation of opportunities for residents in OBGYN and women's health to be trained in abortion care. So there's, again, the demand from people entering the field, and I wish there was more of a demand from women to interview their doctors and kind of figure out, if my doctor doesn't provide the one service that I am likely to need, and that I can be one of the 1 in 3 women by age 45 to need an abortion, I should let that influence who I would choose to be my women's health care provider.
Hmm. Today I'm speaking with Dr. Willie Parker. He provides abortions in clinics in Alabama, Georgia, and the only clinic in Mississippi that provides abortions. He sued the state of Mississippi to keep that clinic open. He prevailed twice, but the fight continues. Dr. Parker is board chair for Physicians for Reproductive Health and author of the forthcoming book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. And this is a pre-taped Your Call. Dr. Parker is in town to receive an award for Planned Parenthood, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls, but we will have Dr. Parker on when his book comes out in a couple of months. You were also featured in the documentary Trapped, and we did a number of shows about that documentary. Here in the Bay Area, there's some protests in front of clinics. There's one in San Francisco where these two men and a woman have really nasty signs, but it's really nothing like what you experience in other parts of the country. In 2005, I visited the clinic in Jackson, and I gotta say, I was not prepared for what I found, and it was so overwhelming. I mean, right when you get out of the car, people scream, "Mommy, don't kill me. Mommy, I love you." I mean, I was so shaken up by that experience, and then walking into the clinic and wondering what these young women, who in some cases were there by themselves, mm-hmm. had to go through. Can you talk about what has changed in terms of just what clinic workers and doctors, the security guards, the janitors, everybody has to deal with just going to work every day?
Well, what has changed is that degree of violence and harassment has ramped up. Even with the Supreme Court decision on behalf of the clinics in Massachusetts, where they kind of decreased the effectiveness of the buffer zone, with the advent of the Trump presidency and people feeling that they now have an administration to do their bidding politically, people are feeling empowered and emboldened around harassing. In the same way, there's tension around immigrant rights. There are people harassing people at abortion clinics. We saw a little over a year ago the shooting up of the Planned Parenthood in Colorado. And that's just, again, the tip of this eruption of this increasing tone of people feeling empowered to harass women, providers, clinic staff. And the people who show up every day to make sure that women have access to these services, the courageous providers, the clinic workers who are having to deal with families and schedules and ostracism, you have the fanatics and you have the committed people. I'm defining fanatics as people who double their effort when they've forgotten their aim. Mm. And I'm defining committed folk as people who know their aim and they double their effort. So that increasing hostility is being met by people who are as resolved as ever to make sure that women have access to the services that they need.
Now, this didn't get much attention when Donald Trump nominated Jeff Sessions to be the Attorney General. I didn't listen to all of the hearings, but based on the articles I read, not many questions, if any, were asked about what he will do to protect clinics, because the Attorney General will make those decisions. Mm-hmm. What do you expect from this administration?
There's an old saying that you can't do what your heart won't let you do. And that we have put someone in the highest office in the land in charge of law enforcement, someone who's directly charged with protecting my safety as an abortion provider and as a citizen. you can't make a half-hearted effort if it's not in your heart to take care of or to protect people. Jeff Sessions has been avowedly and clearly opposed to abortion. His record at every level of government has demonstrated that when he was the Attorney General of Alabama. As a senator, he's been at the vanguard of all of the anti-abortion efforts politically. And I found it disheartening that he was given a pass, that no one confronted him. You know, the good old boys nature of Senate confirmation hearings took precedent. When you have a senator more concerned about what the implications of challenging Jeff Sessions' credibility and his qualifications to be the Attorney General, when you're more concerned about the impact of assailing him on his wife, it says that the gentleman's agreement and the orchestration of that whole thing, where people weren't allowed to challenge him, it says that it's less important for us to have the right person in the job, which for me means somebody willing to protect my safety as an abortion provider, than it was to be congenial and polite and to rubber stamp and to say that the president has a right to have whatever people around him. The president doesn't have a right to abdicate the responsibility to provide equal protection before the law for all the citizens of this country.
What are you hearing from colleagues, providers, clinic workers about what's to come in the next 4 years?
Well, growing up in the South with a lot of mothers around, the older women, when they would look at a civil rights setback, they would say, baby, in times like these, it's always been times like these. Mm-hmm. And that's just to say, I think one of the prevailing thoughts, you know, people in our community, they are, you know, disheartened in the way that everyone is about the tremendous possibility that existed with who we thought was going to be president, with the reality that we now have. But it's new, same thing every day. I think people have dealt with the uncertainty. People have dealt with the open hostility. And those people who are committed know that now more than ever, we have to double down and be resolved to do all that we can politically to hold the line and to not lose our heart to do what we know is the right thing to do.
Dr. Willie Parker provides abortions in clinics in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. He has sued the state of Mississippi to keep the only clinic that provides abortions open. There is just one in the entire state. And he prevailed twice, but the fight continues. Dr. Parker is board chair for Physicians for Reproductive Health and author of the forthcoming book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. He's also featured in the documentary Trapped, which looks at all of the laws that are chipping away at abortion access across the country. You can find that at yourcallradio.org. We did a number of shows about Trapped. Dr. Parker is in town receiving an award from Planned Parenthood. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take your phone calls. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this.
Tonight, the Roxy Theater is hosting a screening of Merchants of Doubt, a documentary about how climate deniers sell doubt about climate change. Following the film, Rose Aguilar will be on a panel to talk about climate change reporting. The film starts at 7 p.m. More information, go to roxy.com.
You're listening to Your Call on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. No calls, as this is a pre-taped Your Call, but your feedback is always welcome. Send an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can listen to the latest KALW stories when you want through the NPR One app. Along with KALW news coverage, you can also easily access NPR shows and stories from across the country in one continuous stream. Download the NPR One app to your smartphone or tablet, point it to KALW, and start listening.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, my guest is Dr. Willie Parker. He provides abortions in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. Dr. Parker is board chair for Physicians for Reproductive Health, and he's author of the forthcoming book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Parker is in town to receive an award from Planned Parenthood. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately, we cannot take your phone calls, but we will definitely have him back when his book comes out in a couple of months. I wanted to ask you about the patients that you work with, because sometimes I feel like we talk about the laws that are passing, how ridiculous some of the laws are, a lot of these laws. But putting a human face to this, Entrapped, which was such an amazing, intense film, you talk about your first patient, a 14-year-old who was gang raped by three guys and a girl. She was 12 weeks pregnant and never had a pelvic exam before. Can you talk about that? I mean, do you think that we don't talk about these stories because it's uncomfortable?
I think we created a climate where, again, when people use cliches like a culture of life or pro-life, or people in legislative situations hide behind numbers and they pass policies and they talk about only so many, this percentage of people will be affected, they lose sight of the fact that these are people's lives. When you can't envision or see yourself in the situation, it's really easy to come up with solutions that you would never be affected by. So I think we have this very unhealthy relationship with sexuality in this mm-hmm. country. We use it to sell things. We talk about it. We do it, but we don't have a healthy affirmative relationship with it. So when the harsh realities about becoming biologically mature and not having healthy affirmative messages about sexuality and not having healthy rites of passage as people transition from childhood to adolescence to adulthood, the people who get caught at the margins are the people who operate in the shadow of our discomfort with real life issues. So if we're not talking to our boys and our girls about healthy sexuality, and we're not teaching our boys to respect their bodies as much as we insist that our girls do, we see the outcome of sexual activity. So if we can only learn from our peers with regard to developed countries like Scandinavian countries where age-appropriate, medically accurate sex education is the expectation, then we equip people to make healthy affirmative decisions around their sexuality. But I think in the absence of that reality, we are stuck with what we have, and that is people are very uncomfortable talking about the harsh realities of sexuality and how that gets modulated by religious puritanism and other things that don't reflect the reality of what information is available, mm-hmm. what the social structures are now as opposed to what they used to be, and how do we navigate those in a way that's affirming of health for our kids.
And the fact that, as you have said, because so many of these laws are designed to chip away at abortion, the South is the most restrictive right now, and it hits women of color and poor women and girls the hardest.
Absolutely. We that's almost like the last shall be first and the first shall be last. When these laws and these policies are made, they're often made in context of non-representative government and people who are not going to be affected by the rules. For example, Mississippi, over almost 50% of the population is black. The legislature, from the governor to both branches of the government, they're almost exclusively white. Now, in a state where the population, the government doesn't look like the population, you don't have to make an indictment of blatant racism when the policies don't reflect the lived experience of the people that they are affecting. And so I think with the conflation of religious values and political power and people not using people who are conflating their personal religious values with the way in which they do group decision making, it's become perilous for folk who aren't represented in those government bodies.
Mm. Do you have conversations with these extreme anti-choice politicians? Do they really oppose abortion, or is this just to get the evangelical vote?
I don't often. I do a lot of advocacy more at the federal level than state level. And when we call on politicians, I'm the chair of an organization called Physicians for Reproductive Health. It's a physician-led advocacy and education organization. And when we do legislative advocacy on the Hill, usually we don't call only on legislators who are supportive of the issues that we champion. We reach out to all. A lot of times, legislators who know what we stand for won't take our meetings. So I think part of what facilitates power and privilege is that it goes unexamined. And what many people do to entrench their position is they create echo chambers, and they only want to hear from people who think like them and who are going to reinforce what they believe. And so I believe that honest disagreement is the beginning of progress, but I don't often get chances to honestly disagree with people.
What explains all of these mostly white men who are so obsessed with this issue? Because when you look at videos of the protests in front of clinics, based on what I've seen, it's dominant white men. What explains this?
Well, human behavior is very complex, and it's always hard to explain. But one of the things that I get into in my book that helps me to try and make some sense of, you know, what was the impetus behind the whole black genocide movement, or framing abortion as a moral evil for black women killing black babies, and it's a conspiracy launched by Planned Parenthood, is if you try and connect the dots and you connect the sense of becoming obsolete that many white people feel with regard to white privilege as America browns, as the world browns, and you look at the fact that men are feeling threatened by men who are patriarchal in the way they see the world are feeling threatened by the burgeoning power of women as they self-actualize, not to the oppression of men, but as they just kind of take their rightful place in a world where men and women are in the world and, you know, there should be proportionate representation in the power. Men who've held absolute power, I think, when you look at women who don't know their place anymore, as they would say, and particularly white women, because the greatest beneficiaries for affirmative action have been white women, when you look at the ways in which white male privilege and patriarchal power is being undermined, the attack of how the most essential thing about a woman being self-determined is control of her fertility. So if you can stop women from using birth control, if you can stop women from ending unplanned pregnancies, then they, of a necessity, are biologically determined to become mothers. And you then can force them into more traditional roles. So it's a very long-winded way of saying that the people who have the most to lose as women control their fertility and assume their rightful place are white men, white male privilege. And so I think that's why there's such a preoccupation with the controlling of women's fertility, because it is the most direct threat to patriarchal privilege and power.
I mean, it's amazing when you think about where we are today versus where we were in the late 60s, early 70s, when mainstream white women who did not really consider themselves feminists, I remember reading a book about Betty Friedan's first march, and these very mainstream women had signs that said free abortion on demand. They did not even consider themselves feminist. Mm-hmm. And look at where we are today.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think there are some people who are feminists, and there are some people who are for equal work, for equal pay, and for sexual freedom, and the freedom from being stigmatized and judged for making the same sexual decisions as men, but they're not necessarily for equality for all women. And so, you know, as feminism has grown and evolved and continues to grow and evolve, one of the things about feminism is that it's becoming a transcendent framework where it's not simply about empowering women, but it's about neutralizing differences in life chances based on gender, which means then it's not such a stretch to understand why I, as a man, become vested in deconstructing systems that oppress women. It's not about I'm being a good guy. It's about me understanding the way in which patriarchy and male privilege compromise us all. And Dr. King used to say the personal well-being is a function of the commonwealth, right? And so half of the commonwealth is female. And so as Abraham Lincoln said, as I would not be a slave, so I will not be a master, I use that same logic to say that I will not participate in patriarchal systems of power that oppress women.
Dr. Willie Parker provides abortions in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. He is in town to receive an award from Planned Parenthood. This is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls, but we will have Dr. Parker back when his forthcoming book comes out. It's called Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Parker is also board chair for Physicians for Reproductive Health. I want to ask you about the laws that are being passed across the country that are chipping away at abortion. I mean, when you look at the Guttmacher website about all of the laws that have been passed, it's just so overwhelming. 38 states require an abortion to be performed by a licensed physician. 43 states prohibit abortions generally except when necessary to protect the woman's life or health. 19 states have laws in effect that prohibit, quote, partial abortion. 17 states use their own funds to pay for all or most medically necessary abortions for Medicare enrolled in the state. In the film Trapped, you talked about what you were obligated by law to offer every woman in the state of Mississippi. And this is a packet of information containing, quote, informed consent resources list. But the information in this list, can I call them lies? What would you call them?
I would call it coercive information that is not medically accurate. We can also call them, now we have a phrase called alternative facts.
Right. So you have to tell girls or women that if you have an abortion, it can increase your risk of breast cancer, even though there's no scientific evidence to support that.
Absolutely. And, you know, facts matter.
Yeah.
And that's why we have to continue to do scientific investigation and make the facts out, even when you have people in power who choose to ignore the facts. If facts didn't matter, there would be no pseudo-facts. There would be no alternative facts. There would be no pseudoscience. And so the affirmation of the importance of scientific facts is validated by the fact that they cannot refute scientific evidence, the best they can do is create equivocation and make it a matter of opinion by creating a parallel set of facts that are pseudoscience. They look like facts, but they're not. They don't stand the scrutiny of scientific investigation. So, the fact that a couple of articles, science is no better than the people doing it. So you can have ideologically driven scientists who will they can play with numbers and make them say whatever they want them to say. But the reality is, people who evaluate medical information and medical evidence have refuted those studies, and so I stand on solid ground when I can stand and say, even though by script I'm required by law to tell you this, in my best medical opinion and interpretation of the medical facts, this is bogus information.
I mean, it was amazing to watch you tell a patient in the film that this is bogus, basically. What kind of responses do you get from maybe young women who don't have the scientific information and aren't sure what to believe?
Well, when they have to interact with abstract information, and I establish my credibility and my objectivity during the course of the encounter. Mississippi is the only state where I'm required to personally give the information. But what I try and help them to understand is that the way in which I'm required to give them information, the type of information I'm required to give them. For example, forcing a young woman to look at an ultrasound without when she doesn't request. The reality is, when women are offered the opportunity, some of them will look and some won't. But being forced to interact with information does not affect the quality or the content of your care. I am able to then help them to put into context the how they're being required to access this care, and I try and use it as an opportunity to radicalize them politically, mm-hmm. not to make them one partisan, but to help them to understand if you're not voting, part of the context in which you're accessing this care is related to the fact that you are allowing people to make decisions about what you're allowed to do with your body. So they react sometimes, and my desired intent is for them to become indignant at the fact that people are interposing themselves in the medical encounter. The physician or the healthcare provider-patient relationship has always been sacrosanct. Until now, we have gyneticians, and we define a gyneticians as a politician who practices medicine without license. Mm-hmm. You have gyneticians inserting themselves into the provider-patient relationship. And so when I can help a woman understand that, it gives the likelihood, it increases the likelihood that she may become politically engaged.
And speaking of these gyneticians, in Trapped, we learn about Americans United for Life. This is a legal advocacy group dedicated to reversing Roe, and they draft model anti-abortion legislation, which is then introduced in states across the country. And so far, their legislation has become law in 23 states. Do you think that if Donald Trump nominates one, two Supreme Court justices, they would actually take on Roe? Do you think that's a possibility? Or is it political suicide?
I think with that the reality is what's most dangerous about this president is we don't know what he will do. Mm-hmm. We only know what he does when what happens at 2 a.m. On Twitter can tell it gives a little bit of indication. But he said that he would appoint a Supreme Court justice. That's why I think we have to watch closely this one. The effort in a politically cynical way, because I really think that Donald Trump personally, who's been who was a friend of the Clintons and who at one point was pro-choice,
right.
It became pro-life only when it was politically expedient. And so I think he'll follow through because that's his base. Now, whether or not if he is successful in his first appointment, where we go back to is where we were when we had before Justice Scalia died. It was 5-4, and the question about what would be the temperament of this person. In the past, presidents have been pleasantly or unpleasantly surprised by what they thought the justices would do. But I think more importantly, I've heard from some of my legal friends that there's this precedent of justices are really hard pressed where something's coded and established firmly in law. Even if you're appointed by a president with that intent, justices would be really loath to overturn Roe. Just as Justice Kennedy has stood firm, and even if Justice Scalia had been alive, it would have been 5-4 with Justice Kennedy, so that the Texas case would have prevailed. I think what that suggests is that even though we can correlate to some degree with who appointed you to the court, what your judicial temperament might be, one of the things we can assume, or at least hypothetically we can assume, is that the people in that, they take the law very seriously. And even if it means pissing off the president who appointed you, a justice wants to be taken seriously about his craft. So I don't know that we can say that this president will appoint two justices and that will be the end of Roe.
Hmm. Dr. Willie Parker provides abortions in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. And this is a pre-taped Your Call, so unfortunately we cannot take any of your phone calls. We saw so many state houses become predominantly Republican in 2010 because of gerrymandering and other issues. And that's when we saw so many of these anti-choice laws really start to pass. How do you think the Democrats have responded to this onslaught of laws and the attacks on women's rights?
I don't think that they've responded very well, given that they haven't been able to stop the train. The Democratic Party has been a bit in disarray. I hope they find their footing and their way. I'm more interested, rather than the revitalization of the Democratic Party, big D, I'm more interested in the restoration of democracy, small d, and progressive politics. And progressive politics would mean whoever puts forth a platform that moves us towards values that reflect the diversity of this country will have my allegiance. I don't know if it's time for a third party yet. It may be, but certainly the way to a third party is the revitalization of the current party that has the greatest potential to reflect our interests. I think that the Democratic Party hasn't done enough to distinguish itself values-wise from the Republican. The politics of electability means that most, whether you're Democrat or Republican, you spend half of your time fundraising for re-election, and so that's left people without a very stark contrast between the Democrats and the Republicans. And so I think to the degree that the Democrats want to revitalize themselves, they are going to have to make a more distinct case for being different than the politicians that are. It should be an easier case to pose progressivism versus fascism. Hopefully now we can make that clear distinction.
What about the large pro-choice groups that closely align themselves with the Democratic Party?
I think everybody understands that if politics is a horse race and everybody wants to have a horse in the race, everybody knows that there are pretty much only two horses in the race, right? And so until there can be another horse, I think people hitch their wagons to the star that they think can take them where they want to go. I think in the absence of campaign finance reform, where Democrats are conceding that it's a money battle, and that I heard somebody say, you have to raise $1 billion to become president. You have to raise $100 million to win a Senate seat, and you have to raise $1 million to become a representative. And people are just saying, if that's the nature of the game, I'm going to play the game the way it's played. So in the absence of getting money out of politics, we're never going to be able to select a different kind of politician.
We like to talk about solutions on this show. It's going to be difficult to get these solutions at the federal level, at least over the next 4 years. But states really have a lot of power. And I wanted to ask you what changes you would like to see. Have you been following what happened in Colorado when a private donor gave a lot of money, the amount escapes me right now, but basically offered IUDs for community clinics, and the teenage pregnancy rate and the unwanted pregnancy rate dropped drastically, in some cases almost 50%. And we did a show about that, and there was some concern about how this affects women of color. People were concerned that these community clinics were just really reaching out to women of color saying, here, don't get pregnant, have an IUD. But we brought on a couple of organizations who said, actually, that did not happen. We did a lot of outreach, and people made their own decisions. What are your thoughts on, are you familiar with that experiment in Colorado?
Mm-hmm.
What are your thoughts on that? I mean, it was amazing to see the pregnancy rate drop by almost half.
Well, we know that over half of all pregnancies in this country are unintended and unplanned. Unplanned doesn't mean unwanted, because over half of the women who have an unplanned pregnancy continue and parent. So what that means is women, if we assume that women are rational, and they are, that they will have babies when they want to have them and that they won't have them when they don't want to have them. I don't think that, if we have more effective contraception and medically accurate sex education, we should be able to trust that women, when they make the decision to be sexual, that decision does not necessarily mean being willing to have a baby if you become pregnant. And so it's no small, what's interesting to me is the notion that we do have a legacy and a history of there being abuse of health policy and power, Tuskegee, and we have contraceptive trials in Central America and Puerto Rico, where women of color and their reproduction was devalued at the expense of technological advancements to allow white women to control their fertility. But the reality is, black women and women of color are rational and sane, and they understand the link between having children and controlling your lives and feeding your children. And so it's kind of insulting to assume that black women, who, if told about the contraceptive options and the most reliable ones would not choose an IUD if it was made possible. The reality is the biggest barrier to IUDs have been the cost of $2,000 in the absence of the Affordable Care Act, for example, making contraception preventive care services and you can't be charged a copay. Women are choosing more active, more effective methods of contraception. And as a result, we have the lowest abortion rate since pre-Roe. So I think it's smoke and mirrors to assume that women of color don't act in a responsible way.
That's what I thought when I saw that. Dr. Parker, 30 seconds left. You travel around the country talking about these issues. You have a new book coming out. Why is this so important to you?
Well, I think I want for women what I want for myself, a life of dignity, health, and well-being. And women who can't control their health and their lives can't control much else. And when women thrive, we all do.
Thank you so much. Dr. Parker provides abortions in Alabama, Georgia, and Mississippi. He's author of the forthcoming book, Life's Work, A Moral Argument for Choice. Dr. Parker, thanks so much for coming in.
My pleasure.
Thank you. Thanks for listening. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
On the next Your Call, why is the promise of upward mobility unattainable for so many? University of Michigan sociologist Kristen Seafelt joins us to talk about her new book, Abandoned Families, Social Isolation in the 21st Century. From low-paying jobs and declining housing markets to school debt and dwindling public safety nets, Seafelt documents the stymied efforts of families striving to enter or stay in the middle class. Join us for the next Your Call at 10 a.m. with Rose Aguilar and you. Your Call is produced at KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer. David LaTulipe recorded today's program. You can email us to feedback@yourcallradio.org.